Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thank you for joining me today wherever you are. My guest this week is a good friend, the award-winning journalist Naren Tulsi. He's worked in journalism for 20 years on various news organizations, or for various news organizations. He was a founder of the now defunct, unfortunately, Con magazine. Continues to work as a freelance writer. He's also an associate editor at New Frame. Our discussion focused on a number of themes that emerge from a couple of Naren's recent writings, including a series of articles about the South African cricketing great Hashim Amla, his Ruth First lecture from 2018 that focused on the state of South African media, his ongoing work about the families of the miners massacred at Marikana in 2012, and a current project where he's looking at politics and violence in KwaZulu-Natal. So through those articles, or the work that he's done on those areas, we're able to look at things around the lack of transformation in sport, and indeed media and business in general in South Africa, the toxic corporate structure, as he sees it, of media in South Africa, and the current state of the ANC as well. So please now enjoy my chat with Naren. Ready to go?
Yeah, man.
So Naren, thanks, for your time. It's been, 2 years in the making?
Sorry for giving you the runaround, Nick.
You're a busy man. I was just sort of trying to think about a way in. I mean, okay, award-winning journalist doesn't quite say it, because you seem to be able to write beautifully and coherently and with a lot of empathy on so many subjects. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, sort of, when you got into journalism, what was the sort of driving thinking behind that? What did you see your role as a journalist? What was that maybe 20 years ago when you started out, or 15 years? Sorry, I must be careful now.
I think it is 20 years ago, dude. I don't think I kind of set out to become a journalist. I went to study journalism in Grahamstown at the university currently known as Rhodes to get away from small town KZN, really. Mm. And I enjoyed writing and I enjoyed reading, which is why I studied journalism. Then becoming a journalist, I come from a political family.
The north coast of KZN, yeah. Stanger, right?
Yeah. And I suppose issues of even before issues of race, I think issues of class were quite apparent in my formative years. So that was one of the drivers when it came to starting to work as a journalist. I mean, my first job was at the Stanger Weekly, which is a knock and drop in the out of Stanger, which is a small town in KZN, right? Mm-hmm. So I worked there for
like the South Coast Herald is to Port Shepstone.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember writing an editorial around the time when the sugar mills were about to close, and being like this gauche kind of university graduate, kind of drawing comparisons with Thatcher and the miners' strike in the early 80s, that kind of stuff. So I'd always had a political awareness and an interest in things outside of my kind of middle class space. I grew up in a small town in KZN, and I think I was maybe 7 or 8 years old when the council built flats across the road from, which it used to be this big bush across the road from my parents' place. And so the council built these big flats there. And they were obviously most of the people there were unemployed or working low-end jobs. So that idea of class kind of became embedded in me as a youngster, even with people that were in my own school, in my own my own class.
Despite the sort of racism that your parents had.
But there's also
yourself had suffered.
So remember, this time it's you're living in a I'm attending an all-Indian school, and I'm living in an all-Indian area, and an area which is quite affluent, because I mean it's a Muslim-dominated area. And then you know these council flats came up, and then it really triggered, I think, a lot of questions in my mind. I remember asking my dad once why, you know, kind of plumbers don't make as much as doctors, and he kind of talked about degree, like, you know, getting a degree and things like that. But I mean, like, even very early on, I was kind of like aware of people who had and people who had not, or the haves and the have-nots. Yeah.
When you say political household, I mean, your parents were then politically active.
Yeah.
What were they? They were professionals.
They were teachers, right?
Oh, okay. So that was always a space of struggle.
Yes. Yes. So I mean, I remember, like, very early on, for example, 1 year we. Like, the whole discussion was around boycotting the Stanger Winter Fair, which was like kind of the, you know, the social event of the year. Because why? Because because one of the other because one of the organizers was a member of the IFP then, and he was a parliamentarian in the tricameral parliament at the time, and that was like a big issue. You know, then one couldn't go to the fair because, you know, it had a semblance of co-option. But my parents also, I mean, they were. So my mom's a physical education teacher, and my dad's like a librarian and a history teacher. So anyway, but they were both involved in sport and sport administration, and so I was kind of like politicized through their participation in organization through organizations like the South African Council on Sport, which is quite a radical non-racial sports body.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, and you know, that's where I first interacted with black kids and colored kids, because I came from a very narrowly confined Indian-only area, and the town was majority Indian. You know, through sport, when we'd go for provincial tournaments, etc., you kind of like then, you know, because it's a non-racial sports organization, so so those kind of engagements, and even then, as 14-year-olds, 10-year-olds, you'd have kind of workshops at the end of in the evenings, you know, after a day's play of tennis, where political questions were raised, were answered. And I'll give you another interesting example. It's kind of like, I remember my sister was playing in an interprovincial tournament in Kimberley, and we were playing in the black courts in the courts of black people in Kimberley, next to the whites only courts, and the blacks only courts didn't have floodlights, and it was getting quite late. And so, like, the caretaker from the whites only court was like, look, you guys can use our courts and complete your tournament. And they were like, and I remember my dad and other administrators having a discussion, and they were like, no, we can't do that, because again, it's kind of like, you know, you're allowing a sense of fake normalcy into a political space.
You're kind of doing us a favor.
Yeah. More than just a favor, it's more like a strident political statement to say, no, you know, we refuse this kind of like, what is it? Like savior complex bullshit.
Tokenism.
Right? Because we don't live in a normal society. Mm. The reason why we're playing divided tournaments is because we don't live in a normal society. And we'll... You know, we'll continue this non-participation, non-engagement with white sports codes, white facilities, white privilege, etc. So instead of playing three sets, I think they did like a one set winner thing to complete the tournament that day.
Yeah,
so it's quite interesting. Yeah,
fascinating. Yeah. Well, I suppose that does explain now, or puts in context for me quite interestingly. The way you do engage with sport in your writing, and I mean, you know, obviously.
I've given you an in, Nick.
Thanks. You've written a couple of times about Hashim Amla.
Yeah.
You have now an article out with this media, what do I call it? A
media platform.
Platform, yeah. New Frame.
Yeah.
But was it last year you wrote about, what was the title of the article again? Just remind me.
Which one?
The previous article. On
about Amla?
Yeah.
The Rainbow Beauty of Hashim Amla.
The Rainbow Beauty of Hashim Amla, exactly. You had written, in fact, a little bit about him before that as well. It wasn't the first time you'd written about him. But I'm just, it makes more, not that it needed to make sense for me, but I can understand now through your history how you've become sort of so engaged with him as an icon, as a symbol of something.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, so his elder brother, Ahmed Amla, who was a provincial cricketer for KZN.
And that's what I wanted.
Yeah, so I mean, he...
Because the different paths are quite, just in a moment in time.
So he went to the school that my mum taught at.
Huh.
So that's interesting. And my mom was a physical education teacher. Then he was the ducks. He was kind of the sports boy and like kind of the, but he never kind of, and he talks about it, I think, in interviews, like how he could never make that extra step up because as talented as he was, and Hashim talks about like how his brother is actually more talented than him in the sports that they've played as kids.
Exactly.
He could never, because he didn't have that same exposure at that formative, like that very important moment in his life because he was still playing non-racial, blacks-only cricket, whereas Hashim goes to DHS at the age of, I think, like 15 or 16, and then has instilled in him the kind of batting technique which you kind of need to learn from institutions, you know, it's kind of, or at the very least from really good coaching.
And also at a time of like significant change, just in the way sport was then sort of being restructured as well, I suppose. So the pathway was all of a sudden just different for Hashim to Ahmed. Or
yeah, it was, but the pathway was also kind of like still had a ceiling, right? Because I know so many really talented sportsmen who didn't make it because of that institutional racism that existed even at a time when we're supposed to have been unified and, you know, like the sporting bodies had come together. Mm. So, I mean, I don't think there was any rigorous pursuit of transformation or to bring into the white establishment fold black youngsters at that point. I think it's only become more apparent to white sporting codes and institutions that from schools all the way up to national associations, that at some point you're gonna have to, like, you know, largen your pool.
Yeah.
And you can see that kind of change happening at DHS at a particular point because Amla is so, so good. We're talking about 98, 99. Mm. He's so good and he's bringing such glory to school. Right? Yeah. I mean, they're so cool that they just have like a one name. So the idea if he's, and he's not abrasive. He fits in. So he's middle class. He fits in at a time where his race and his religion don't matter as much as the fact that here's one of the grandest sporting institutions in our country, you know, which has produced over 30 national South African cricketing caps, quite a few English national caps as well. And for them at that point, it's not about the color. And I think that kind of like filtered up at some point to rugby unions, to cricket unions at provincial level and to the national team. But still, you're still coming from a very narrow pool of players who come through like sort of established institutions rather than a more...
Yeah, I mean, this is what I want to get onto, that transformation. I mean, I'm interested to hear what you have to say about what the government's role in all of this is, or you know, state structures, because it seems to me that certainly within most sporting codes now, and that would be for netball or hockey, particularly rugby and cricket, not so much football, because... I think there's just a different history there, of course, that the path to success for any black athlete is through a Model C or some kind of private school, through a sports bursary, or through some exceptional kind of skill that is just sometimes just discovered by accident, not through any sort of vast catchment or organized or structured process to find these kids. So... What? How do we sort of even, because you look at our sort of current young sporting role models, Themba Bavuma or Kagiso Rabada or Siya Kolisi, for example, as in rugby, Springbok captain, God bless him. But you still get a sense that they are kind of fortunate in a way to have been even found.
And
how do we sort of make it that anyone can have a chance? I mean, where are the rugby schools? Where are the cricket clubs? Where are the rugby fields in Soweto or in any township that are meant to be fostering this kind of thing? This is my bugbear, I have to say.
Yeah. I think it's more difficult to create a more equal, egalitarian, normal society from which, or like sporting society from which to create elite sportsmen now than it was in 1990. And 1990 is significant because we're looking at a point where SACOS, now the South African Council on Sport, were still maintaining the idea of no normal sport and abnormal society. They refused to unify, right? because they wanted.
Was that Sam Ram Sammy?
No, no, that was Sasskok, and then Sam Ram Sammy was the National Sports Congress, which then becomes I think the kind of interloper in that conversation which is happening, because the National Sports Congress didn't really have grassroots structures, right? It kind of emerged through the ANC from like
sports boycotts.
Yeah, yeah, from the late 80s. Yeah, onwards. Organized sport in South Africa was run by SACOS, right? Okay. So what happened is, so the NSC then has a greater role in the negotiation process. SACOS is saying, look, we need guarantees around, okay, facilities. We want to see a proper like short term, medium term, long term plan around transformation of sport, i.e., the Department of Sports, what money is going to put into kind of creating facilities, training coaches, providing access, but also at the same time see a normalizing of our society where poor black people. For example, like Mfuneko and Gum, would not be at a disadvantage because of the diet that they've been exposed to when it comes to competing against white athletes. So they wanted a kind of a normalcy before South Africa would be allowed back into the international fold, because at the time, you remember, there was a moratorium on sports in South Africa playing international sports.
Yeah.
The National Sports Congress, and I think there's mainly Thabo Mbeki at the time, they were very keen to use sport as a rainbow nationalist tool. So for them, like, you remember the vote for the World Cup, the first World Cup that yes no vote that we had just before the World Cup that South Africa participated in for the first time. So like those considerations,
the Cricket World Cup in Australia.
So those considerations about creating a normal level sport playing field, excuse the pun, for black kids was kind of lost in this imperative towards a rainbow nationalism that the ANC was pushing towards, which then finds great articulation in the 95 Rugby World Cup, the 96 African Nations Cup football victory, etc. So that was part, which that's why if we'd kind of held back a bit then and held the white establishment national associations to ransom at a particular, but not ransom, but essentially held out for them to make commitments, for the government and the Department of Sports to make commitments, then we would have a very different kind of leveled playing field now. Mm-hmm. Now we've almost become kind of, I suppose, fossilized in this idea of elite schools producing elite sports.
Yeah, that's enough for us.
So, I mean, our pool's gotten a little bit wider, but not that much. It's still the middle class and the upper middle class kind of like success that you're seeing in our sports teams.
Yeah. One of the phrases you used in that Rainbow Beauty of Hashim Amla, because you're sort of reflecting as well on kind of just his acceptance or non-acceptance within white sports.
His visibility and invisibility, yeah.
You talk about the white struggle for empathy and tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about those beards as a sort of seen by a lot of those kids as sort of homage to. Mm-hmm. They think they're sort of paying respect, but it kind of strikes me as almost being like a blackface kind of thing. I mean, yeah. I don't. How do you sort of? Well, look at that, because you think, oh, that's so cool. They love Hashim Amla, and they're able to accept him as a Muslim, I suppose, if that's what the beard signifies. But I don't know, it somehow
feels
a bit funny.
It grates, because, I mean, you're essentially reducing somebody to, physical characteristic, whether it's kind of like the color of your skin or the length of your beard. And I think Moeen Ali, similarly, like very politely, I think in an interview I remember, talked about, the hashtag, hashtag the beard to be feared kind of thing, which comes out on Twitter a lot whenever he's bowling or batting, and he very politely expressed a little bit of discomfort around it. But sportsmen are quite anodyne in their responses generally. Myself, I think it's what's the word? It's kind of a toneless,
tone deaf
kind of support, which still comes from a space that isn't very reconstructed, I think. It almost suggests that you can't get past the beard, and that he is the beard, and that's all he is, when he's kind of a lot more complex and contradictory than just the beard.
And one of the great cricketers of the modern era, without a doubt. I mean, you look at those stats, especially his one-day stats, where he's not really even, I don't think, recognized perhaps as a one-day batsman as much as he is a test batsman.
Yeah.
And he's first to
200, 2,000, quickest 3,000.
To 2,000, all of those. Mm-hmm.
Faster than Viv Richards, who was another brutal flayer of bowlers and misconceptions of white superiority.
Just a serene presence at the crease and just a beautiful.
Yeah.
What do you think his legacy will be? Do you think he strives or because he seems to, in that article, not to want to say too much about
Well, he said
himself as a political or even as a role model in general.
Yeah.
What do you think his legacy will be?
Yeah. I think in that article, I mean, off the record, he's certainly a bit more political than he comes across. And he's a smart young man. And I think he thinks quite deeply about his role in South Africa and his role as a cricketer. But right now, and he kind of suggests that, look, a lot of this stuff will come out in his autobiography whenever that's going to come out. But the legacy, I mean, it's interesting. It seems the older I get, my memory and the cannabis that I've been kind of addicted to kind of affects my memory a little bit. But I was reminded of the Darwish poem that he wrote, kind of Mahmud Darwish wrote. I think it's called The Bird's End. And I quote it in this piece that's out in New Frame about kind of the singular journeys we're on and the footsteps we take over rocks that I've never seen feet before and the new horizons that we kind of... we open up with these journeys, you know, even when they come to an end, we've created a new horizon for people who will retrace our footsteps and then go further. And I think that for me is his interesting role in South Africa, because what he's done, and it comes back to the C.L.R. James quote of, what do they know of cricket who only cricket knows? Mm. And James responds, the answer is in both facts and in the imagination. And I think what Amla has challenged white South Africa, and he's challenged, well, perhaps not to the profound degree that you would hope for, judging by the number of beards at Newlands, but he's challenged the white South African public, he's challenged the white South African media to kind of rethink a lot of, I think, their own prejudices and racism when it comes to things like notions of political interference in sport, the idea of quota players, the idea of standards, what is a South African as well, who is a South African, also the place that Muslims have in our society. So I think he's really challenged us to extend our imaginations and because he's so staggeringly good. We couldn't ignore some of those, some of the challenges, and it's not necessarily an overt challenge. What it is more kind of just with the elegance of his batting, the serenity of his time at the crease. He's made us actually rethink our prejudices and like kind of again fossilized notions of kind of who we are and what we are as a country, and I think that's important.
Hmm. Last year, you were a Ruth First Fellow at Wits. And you produced a paper there that used the metaphor of fire to look at the South African media, and I'll put a link to that article on the website. I don't want to get too much into it, but it was really maybe you can tell me. For me, it was a reflection on the state of the South African media, on the corporate, the almost destructive hold that corporate media has on journalism in this country, on the sort of legacy of apartheid in our newsrooms, and also confronting the threat or the trend or whatever you want to call it of social media and what that is doing to newsrooms, news organizations, and for the truth in media you spoke about, are journalists still able to be the witnesses and the writers of the first drafts of history?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair? I mean, I don't want to take words right out of your mouth. I mean, what were you trying to say something?
I was trying to work through my depression over the state of South African media. I'm glad somebody was listening. I was going to read it later on at some point. I mean, Yeah, I mean, I suppose it was kind of... The idea of journalism and what is a journalist, I think, has changed because of this digital moment that we're in. But I think what a lot of us haven't realized are things that... The simple things. Journalism remains the same regardless of where it's published. Right? Journalism is about fact establishment. It's about building contacts. It's about corroborating evidence that is given to you. It's about, where... And those things get... It's about kind of like connecting with... it's like that scene from The Wire. It's like where I think one of the characters is talking about what is good police, right? Mm. And he talks about kind of like, you know, somebody who's got kind of a pulse on the street corners, who knows kind of like, you know, before, as soon as something happens, you're going to get a call from your source to say like, look, this is going down. But somebody who also has a fastidious need to follow paper trails and to kind of like, you know, build evidence over time, right? Mm. And that hasn't changed, and it shouldn't change, but it is changing because of this hysterical need to publish first or to just kind of like get clickbaits in by like repackaging, say, you know, Amu Bongani do an expose and then the News 24 kind of just rewrite it and then put it up there without having looked at any of the source material. That's not journalism. That's an aggregation, and journalism is a very different thing. So it was kind of like, I suppose it was a challenge to South African media. It's also about like kind of raising issues which sometimes we don't talk about because South African media sometimes, and I think it's media nationally, you know, we kind of quite polite with each other. You know, we don't kind of publish like too hectic stuff unless it's Iqbal Survey and Andrew Bonomo going at each other from the Sunday Times and independent newspapers, right? Yeah. But usually we're quite polite. For like, I mean, one thing that I never see talked about in this crisis that we're having in South African media is the concentrated toxic ownership model that we have. And we have like super toxic owners. Andrew Bonomo at Times Media Group, which then became Tiso Detsta.
Which has changed the name again now.
Yeah, they've been so.
I mean, owners.
I mean, he stripped a very profitable company. Likewise, Trevor Ngube at the Mail and Guardian, who's now in Zimbabwe, thankfully. He made some of the most awful decisions in media history, and that's why the Mail and Guardian is in the financial position it is now. We talk about Naspers, you know, that history that it has, that you know, the very nature of its reporting, its institutionalized racism that exists there, that still exists there, which is anti-queer, anti-black, anti-women. You know, I mean, these are things that we don't talk about because we're so focused on digital migration as the main issue, that we're not being honest with ourselves about the other like multiplicity of issues which are affecting us as a sector.
I mean, I mentioned that white struggle for empathy and tolerance in sport, and I think it could probably be applied to sort of the media as well in some respects.
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, we're increasingly disconnected. I think that was part of the paper, part of the issue. One of the themes I was trying to raise in the paper, it's you know, the journalists are there to kind of tell other people's stories, you know, to be connected, to follow paper trails, to have empathy. But we're part of the elite, and in this like technological age, because of things like social networking platforms, etc., we're increasingly dislocated from the people we should be spending more time with, and the people who are kind of like, you know, kept out of the public conversation, who are marginalized because of, you know, economics, race, class, etc., and don't have a voice. And we don't represent that voice sometimes in our reporting. So,
well, now you've given me another lovely intro to your work on the widows and, well, families of Marikana. The Marikana.
Yeah.
You wrote some really fantastically poignant, without being soppy, articles about the sort of long term impact of that massacre. For the Mail and Guardian, it was.
I think that was a
unique. That was quite a space you were given there.
And time.
How did
you? 44 families to track down and spend time with.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
With your. Who's the photographer?
Paul Burgess.
Paul, who I met. How did you initially get involved in that Marikana story? Were you writing stories on Marikana before the massacre took place, and how did that happen?
Interestingly enough, Nick, on the morning of the massacre, I landed back in South Africa from Sweden.
Huh.
And I was there for a music festival and like to visit some friends in Stockholm. So I was completely oblivious to what was going on. So Thursday, and that was on a Thursday. So Thursday's deadline day at the Mail and Guardian. I worked there at the time. And I remember Paul coming to the Zuleik Bowls Club afterwards, kind of like, because the Mail and Guardian goes to bed at 6 o'clock. The massacre happened at like 10 to 3. So like, you know, shit was going down, and he was kind of like really edgy and stuff. And so that's actually how I first heard about it.
Yes.
So then obviously, you know, after the massacre, because I was on holiday for like 3 weeks or something. So I mean, you know, we go to Marikana, we kind of like investigating, trying to figure out what's going on. Everybody's kind of like, you know, trying to figure out like what is going on.
The sequence
of
events.
Yeah, I mean, because this is also like, you know, this is the bloodiest moment in post-apartheid South Africa's history. You know, I mean, our democratic government has murdered 34 of its own citizens on that day. 10 people were killed before, some killed by striking miners, etc. So the project itself, which is a long-term project, which is still not ended, and it's called After Marikana, and Paul and I are going to come up with a book on the 10th anniversary called After Marikana, and we're also trying to do a virtual reality memorial using a lot of the photography and the video and the evidence there, but something that which is not about kind of trauma and violence porn, something which is like kind of very sensitive sensitive. So what happened was, so Marikana happens and we're all trying to figure it out. We're there, we're running around. And so Paul actually goes to the funeral of one of the miners, Mr. Musebetsane, who lives in the middle of nowhere in Lesotho. When he goes there for the funeral, and on my first visit there, we leave Maseru, we drive for about 3 hours, then the road ends, so we got to like park the 4x4, and like it's getting like steeper and steeper as we go along, right? So like 2 hours out of Maseru, or like 3 hours out of Maseru, I can't remember. So we park the 4x4 at a school, and then the herdsman from the widow's herdsman, Mrs. Motsebetsani's herdsman, kind of come to collect us, and we the last 2 hours we've got to walk. At one point I try to kind of get on this horse, and like, but I mean it's like serious ravines. You're in the middle of like nowhere, right? I mean it's gorgeous. I mean it's really beautiful. The air is like really thin, and the water is clear, but it's in the middle of nowhere. So it took us like a few hours to get to
the site, the homestead.
And Paul had been there. The first time he'd been there, he was struck by the physical remoteness of this place, but also I think the political and psychological and emotional remoteness in terms of kind of how the families were being treated. I mean, the place is so inaccessible. Like literally, Mr. Musebetsane's body was like had to be flown in there. Like his coffin had to. And the irony is that he'd always had this dream of like saving up and taking his family on a flight to go to Durban or something. And like, you know, and the only flight he'd ever taken
was in his coffin
back home. So Paul was struck by the remoteness of all this and the treatment that they were receiving. I at the time had quite a good relationship with the lawyers who were representing the families of the miners who were killed on August 16th, because they also represented a lot of shack dwellers in Durban, where I'd done a lot of work when I was based in Durban working for the Mail and Guardian. So we started a conversation about kind of, you know, like really trying to track what happens afterwards to these families. And what was going to initially be, we published, I think, on the first anniversary, we'd managed to get to 34 of the families, excuse me, who had, of the men who had died on August 16th. There were 10 men who died in the 10 days before. So we'd managed to get to the 34, and just only. And what had initially been, we thought of like 3, 4, 5 year project max, now has just kind of evolved and changed because, you know, circumstances change. People change, kids grow up, you know. I've seen kids who going to like rural schools couldn't speak a word of English, Now, because like Lonmin have paid for the education, now going to kind of Model C schools and you know their English is amazing. They're doing really well in maths and science. They're playing chess. It's like that kind of stuff happening. But at the same time, what you're also seeing is like intergenerational trauma. For example, in one instance, one of the family's 15-year-old kid. He moved to from the Eastern Cape to a Model C school in Kokstad, and kind of he was bullied and like really. I think he wasn't really dealing well with kind of like some of the Marikana-related bullying there. And on the first day of a new term, he calmly like left his boarding school one morning, went to the hardware store, bought a bottle of rat poison, a string of rope, and went and got a bottle. And we know this because there was a till slip in his front pocket, and a Valpray bottle of water. Went down to this area near the river near Kokstad, where the drain pipes move out, and kind of mixed the water with the rat poison, drank it, and just to make sure, kind of hung himself. So I mean, you've had three suicides after Marikana. So there's that, but there's also agency. There's like green shoots of kind of happiness. There's also like people moving on with their lives, you know, and starting new lives. So the idea is not with this project is not just to kind of represent, and the media has done this a lot. It's kind of like, you know, it's always weeping widows, kind of, you know, fainting at the Farlam Commission, completely disempowered, whereas they have a lot of agency. Some, like, you know, there are a couple of, like, the Nokamba, Mrs. Nokamba, for example. I mean, she's moved from the rural Eastern Cape, where she's, you know, she's had patriarchy oppressing all the time, where, you know, it's like the male elders in her family telling her what to do, etc. And now she's working at Lonmin, which is still a penury, but she's discovered agency. She's unionized with AMCU. She's a member of the EFF. You know, like things like that. So these are the kind of stories which move, which take you through the trauma and the violence and the callousness of the state, which has always criminalized these families. And we're just trying to tell very subtle, nuanced stories of this journey, which would hopefully also like tell us a little bit about our own journey as a country, you know, moving towards this bloody moment and hopefully moving away from it and what it means and the relationship between the state and citizens, which is a really area of interest for me as well.
And I suppose, I mean, the great irony is in the deaths of those miners, those families have, I suppose, found some sort of freedom or opportunity that they perhaps never would have had through the slave wages of their husbands.
In some instances not. I mean, but there's also, like, you remember, like, Lonmin offered the families who were killed on August 16th an opportunity to replace the dead husbands in the mine. But this came very late, towards the end of the Farlam Commission. So, like, two years after the massacre, they kind of, I think they figured it'll work well for them on a PR level to kind of do this, right? So they open up the opportunity. But what you have now is also kind of like...
What do you mean by replace?
I.e., they would be given a job at Lonmin.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I mean, so in some instances you have sons working there. In one or two instances, Betty Gadlela, who replaced her husband, she works underground. But most of them work cleaning toilets and the showers for the company that is essentially partially responsible for the murders of their husbands. That's a problem, right? When the other problem is, like, whereas previously you had a broken nuclear family with a father away as a migrant labor, now you've got kids away at boarding school and no parents at home. Yeah. Or in some instances, for example, and this the other suicide, Mrs. Zimbambele, she went to work at Lonmin. And she, you know, she's got a job kind of working underground, and her daughter, who's 21 years old, she was kind of essentially left in charge of the family. And Mrs. Zimabela has a big family because there's also kind of kids from her husband's first marriage, etc. And then her husband's mother's child, which was kind of like dumped on her at some point as well, because there was an attempted reconciliation before her husband died. So she's so her daughter commit suicide because she couldn't handle having to go from being kind of like a footless, fancy-free young lady to suddenly being the matriarch of the house, you know? Mm. And also there's other inherited trauma there. So, like, you know, she didn't have a chance to grow up properly. So it's a two-edged sword. Hey?
What did it say to you about the migrant labor system? I mean, it's
fucked.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit of an obvious question. Yeah. But I'm just saying, I mean, you saw it sort of close up and personal. You kind of, I suppose it shows that one thing that I would think is that in our post-apartheid society that the economic relations are still kind of very pre-apartheid.
Yeah. I'll give you a good example of kind of why, for me, black economic empowerment and this kind of pretense that we've transformed the economy and how we do business in this country is so intertwined in Marikana. I mean, a lot of the media have kind of focused on Cyril Ramaphosa's role as a non-executive director and the emails he sent calling for concomitant action, right? But what they don't really focus on, and I think this is indicative of the problem we have when it comes to capitalism, whether it's, you know, blackface, whiteface, whatever, capitalism is capitalism, right? So, I mean, Ramaphosa is one of the founders of the largest unions in South Africa, the National Union of Mine Workers in the 80s, right? And he led one of the longest strikes at the time in the 80s. So you would think when he came on board to get a slice of the Lonmin Platinum Pie, edging out workers in that particular instance as well, because there was the BE component were supposed to be like a worker representative component at Lonmin, and Ramaphosa edged them out and got in there, right? His one job, he had one thing to do. That was to be chairperson of the Transformation Committee. The Transformation Committee, its job was to ensure that Lonmin complied with its social and labor plans. Now, the social and labor plans are the plans that any mining company puts to government to say, look, we've got a migrant labor system which is rapacious. We know we're environmentally problematic. There are all these issues. What we're going to do, if you give us a mining license, is that we're going to ensure that maybe schools will be built for communities around the mining area, or we're going to kind of, you know, clean the water, or like, or whatever, right? And these need to be complied with. If they're not, the Department of Mineral Resources has a right to revoke your license, right? So we have really great legislative infrastructure to transform mining and our economy. So Ramaphosa at the Farm Commission of Inquiry admits during cross-examination by Tembeka Ngukaitobi, who's representing the Legal Resources Center right now, at the commission at the time, that he'd never read a single report from the Transformation Committee. And Lonmin, in 2006, when he got its mining license, had pledged to build 5,500 family unit houses for their workers by 2011, so that you wouldn't have a migrant labor system with a broken nuclear family. Well, what you would be able to do is like bring your family from the Eastern Cape, and like you can live there, right? By 2011, Lonmin had built two show houses. Nothing was done, you'll see there from there what happens, that Lonmin is still refurbing some of its other hostels. So what it means that a lot of miners then moved into the shack settlement in Kaneng, where they're given a living out allowance, right, to like find accommodation while we do something with the hostel situation here. But what that leads to is, these miners kind of spend, and I'm not excusing infidelity or things like that, but I'm just, it's an interesting point. I mean, these miners probably see their families twice a year, at Easter and at Christmas. So you go large periods of the year emasculated and whatever, right? So I mean, the sex work is a big issue in any mining town. And so what you have is kind of men now, instead of living in a hostel with kind of eight guys in a room where it's a lot harder to kind of get out of hand, you're now living in a shack. And before you know it, you have a second family that you've got to support in the shack, because your girlfriend becomes a bit more serious. She's not just there like once a month or whatever the case. And that added an extra financial pressure on these miners. The fact that now you had two households to support, and you didn't really have that living out allowance, which was about like 1,300 rand, didn't really cover much. I think that's an example of like how economically we fail. And because you would think somebody who had started the largest miners union in the country would go, hold on a second, you know, the migrant labor system is a problem. And a few months before the Marikana massacre, I think Ramaphosa wrote a piece in the Mining Weekly essentially saying housing was a problem, migrant labor was a problem, yet he was completely deaf to the miners and the workers in his own mine. And, you know...
Well, I mean, the way that this government now is carrying on still about mining, mm-hmm. and, I mean, you've been down to Golobeni as well, which is where Gwede Mantashe has been,
mm-hmm.
Also seemingly kind of tone deaf to the pleas of the community. And he's another one who's got a history of activism in the trade union movement. So, I mean, how do we explain that? Is it just...
It's difficult, right? I mean, like, Gwede may be a little bit different from Cyril, because I think he still seems to believe the mine worker. This is where I think unions have a role to play. You know, I mean, mining unions need to kind of realize their own mortality and the longevity of mines and the fact that to save the planet, we need to kind of move on. And they've been very oppositional to reskilling their members towards kind of like greener energy production. And I think if the mining unions came on board, I think that would also like shift Gwede's approach and possibly Ramaphosa. But then Ramaphosa's approach is very, very much different, because he's got interest in all these, and his bras have interest in all these like kind of mines and stuff, right? So, I mean, he's always been a little like kind of little Randlord Fauntleroy anyway. I mean, it's a difficult one.
I just want to go back to... just to talk a little bit about your sort of current work now. I mean, I started off by saying you write about so many different topics. You've been in KwaZulu-Natal following the whole Gleblans.
Less Gleblans, more just the conflation of politics and violence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I mean,
but Gleblans, but also in other areas as well. Yeah.
So
Gleblans,
I mean,
less so than others.
How does the politics what does the politics of the ANC in particular in KwaZulu-Natal say about the sort of current state of our politics and of the ANC in particular? Yeah. Would you say? Are you happy to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we can talk about it to a point, I suppose. Look, I mean, I think what's happening, what we're seeing in KZN, which is quite interesting for me, is the apogee of the Zuma project within the ANC. You know, it's a realization, I think, a pre-Polokwane realization on like how one consolidates power within the party and how one maintains power within the party, right? And it's a conflation of state and party, i.e. at regional level, where you can control branch memberships, right? Numbers, where you can control what meeting is a branch meeting is legitimate and what isn't, right? At regional level, what you're seeing is kind of a patronage network that has developed since probably before Polokwane, but which has kind of become more aware of itself and has kind of like solidified itself since Polokwane, and become more desperate
in a way,
and become and raise more and more momentum and short-termism. Because what happens is that your aim is to become regional chairperson. What that means is that kind of then you become district mayor or municipal mayor and stuff, and then so you have kind of control of the state coffers, which you then use to divert money back into kind of like how you ensure you still have voting banks with the ANC, etc., right? But on top of that, you have layers of kind of IFP infiltration of the ANC, in many instances with the compliance of the ANC leadership, because what the ANC has done is, on some level, and what the Zuma project has done in terms of like the electoral numbers, is essentially replaced an IFP feudalism in terms of voting, like voting for elections and stuff, and national elections I'm talking about, not the ANC, with an ANC feudalism. So you've created, the aim is to create maskandis and voting cattle, people who will sing and shout you down at ANC conferences and vote for you, right? So the power is maintained at regional level. But then what's happened is that kind of people have realized now, okay, this is how the system works. They realized it after Polokwane. It gained kind of momentum. But now it's kind of like, because regional conferences happen kind of every, I think it's every 2 years, provincial conferences happen every 4 years, you've got like this kind of like this constant factional kind of like battle happening to like kind of get to those positions to ensure you have power.
For the next and step. Then,
and the comrade who voted with you and for you in the last election is now kind of gunning for you, literally gunning for you. And what you're seeing is a lot of people being killed, whether they're whistleblowers, whether they're factional opposition, or even just like kind of people with integrity who are critical of the way the ANC is evolving. You know, it's kind of like what Lenin warns about. You know, the grandstanders and the careerists and the loudmouths joining the revolution, right, and sabotaging it. And this is what you're seeing in the ANC in KZN, more amplified because it is kind of like the heart of the Zuma project. Mm.
So that project is to some degree then quite alive and definitely kicking.
But remember, now it's less about Zuma even, because the national politics...
It's just to maintain that, because circle of patronage.
Yeah, but he triggered this thing and he's still trying to harness it. But what happens is that, it's also about kind of hyper-local politics. It's about like, you know, what am I going to eat? What car am I going to drive? You know, who do I control? So sometimes it's less about the national politics of Ramaphosa versus NDZ and much more about kind of like, okay, I will nail my mask to your, I will nail my colors to your mask and I will deliver you X number of votes come provincial conference, come national conference, etc. But then you're allowed a bit more leeway when it comes to certain things.
It's that whole, it seems that it's at that branch level really that things have kind of broken down in a way that, or it's at the branch level that the system or the structure seems to be very susceptible to manipulation.
Yeah,
that there's not enough been done to see who this person is that wants to become a member. Or
well,
is it possible to vet your people more closely? I mean, what would that take?
Well, I've been speaking to ANC members who say, you know, the ANC is not like FICA. You know, you can't. It's not computerized, and it's exactly that, right? Mm-hmm. This is an interesting little piece of evidence as well, I think. Or it'll kind of like,
an aside
to help kind of like understand the situation, right? So every Secretary General of the ANC and at his national organizational report at Polokwane, at Nazareth, at Mangung, etc., have bemoaned the fact that ANC branches are not connected to their communities. They only exist when there's an election, i.e. a national or municipal election time, or an internal ANC election, right? That's when they kind of get activated. So that's the first problem. That sense of activism doesn't exist within the ANC. The second problem is, like, I think it's to become a member of the ANC, it costs 50 rand. Right. So what we've seen is like the people with money and financial interests and the careerists going, well, I'll pay the membership fee for 500 people and, you know, and I'll give them cell phones, or whatever. And then I own them when it comes to voting. Right. Then because of what you also haven't laid on top of that is gatekeeping and violence. So, for example, you had that quite a bit, I think, leading up to Mangung, where in Itekweni specifically, there are lots of branches who were opposed to Zuma. And Itekweni was a very close-run thing in terms of like coming out for Zuma, leading into Mangung, closer than people kind of make it out to be. So what would happen is that when BGMs were had to be held to correlate to deal with issues of national conferences and stuff, you would have armed security, in some instances even police, kind of people keeping people out of meetings. You would have kind of violence in meetings. You would kind of, or what you would do is like kind of one faction would say, okay, the BGM is going to be held at at Killarney Golf Club, but it's actually going to be held at the, you know, Saxon World Tribune. So it's kind of like, you have all of that manipulation going on layers and layers of it. And an interesting story. So Newcastle, where the mayor, murder charges against the mayor of Newcastle were dropped about 2 months ago, right?
Right.
And he had initially been charged with the murder of an ANC Youth League leader, who was shot dead in a township shebeen, I think in 2016. So the interesting thing there is that the mayor of Newcastle emerged as a regional chairperson of the Newcastle area, Emala Shleni, in 2014. Right, there was an appeal by the opposing faction saying there were issues around people who were not eligible to attend the conference who were there, and also that some of the members who are now serving on the REC hadn't actually spent 5 years. You need to spend 5 years an ANC member before you qualify for
a regional executive committee.
Yeah, yeah. Hadn't spent 5 years. So, and I know this because I've got provincial executive committee, provincial working committee minutes and meeting and notes and reports. So there was an appeal, and the ANC at provincial level was going to investigate. Before they were going to investigate, before they started the investigation, the ANC office burned down with all the membership files. So it's like you have that kind of stuff. And it's interesting because the mayor, you're innocent until proven guilty, but it's very interesting that in the case of the mayor of Newcastle, the state withdrew the charges because they had six witnesses when they instituted the charges in March. In May, they had five witnesses because one witness was gunned down in like daylight on a Sunday afternoon in public and murdered, right? So they had five witnesses. Four of the witnesses then recanted their statements saying that...
we saw nothing.
Yeah. So I mean, kind of like it's dodgy, yes.
Not nice.
Yeah.
Naren, let's, before we just finish up here...
What, we're already done?
Time flies when you're having fun, dude. New Frame.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me a little bit about New Frame, what it is, what the purpose is, what you're trying to do there? Because cool. You're, as I understand it, you're one of the editors there?
I'm loosely affiliated with it. I've kind of like consulted. I was associate editor-ish kind of vibe.
Okay,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's hopefully a new way of kind of doing media. Not just, it's pro-worker, it's kind of like, I think it's like kind of pro-marginalized communities and kind of like how it tries to do reporting with nuance. It's not about, it's about like quality rather than clickbait. And again, doing longer form pieces, more nuanced and detailed pieces, not the kind of like the 24-hour news cycle kind of stuff, but responding to the 24-hour news cycle, but in a more considered way. So there's that, which is an online platform, but it's also about kind of building a community. So Newframe are setting up an event space and a bookshop. With left-wing literature, because it is avowedly unashamedly left-wing and pro-worker. So a bookshop with the kind of like really interesting material there, and an event space where there'll be, you know, book launches, music, performances, talks, etc. So it's kind of like hopefully kind of, I suppose, appealing to the finer sensibilities that we used to have before we became completely anesthetized and atomized by the moment in which we live, which is kind of like, you know, always under an outrage cascade in the middle of an information silo. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hopefully a new way of doing it.
What is the business model then? I mean, is it do you have a rich benefactor? I mean, is that the sort of future model for progressive media these days?
Well, I suppose, you know, media have always had benefactors and families, yeah, right? The Boston Globe and others, like, yeah. That you'd have to kind of speak to the higher ups.
Because everyone's talking about, you know, new business models and what those new business models are. I mean, how to sort of generate income at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Be relevant or whatever. And I'm just sort of intrigued that...
Well, look, I mean, at the moment there's funding,
I mean,
right?
I'm fascinated that there is a space for that kind of... project, and indeed that there are people interested in giving money to that. Yeah. I actually don't, I mean, for me, give too many shits about that. In fact, the fact that the platform, I think, exists, and without too much editorial interference from whoever's funding the project, I think is probably What you would hope for in any kind of media organization, right?
Yeah, I mean,
whether it's corporate advertising or a philanthropist or whoever.
Yeah, look, I mean, I know there's Silicon Valley money, which is kind of, which doesn't impact on the autonomy, editorial autonomy. I think if there was an issue around editorial autonomy, myself and a lot of other people would not be working there. So this, Silicon Valley money with an idea towards kind of creating a community and then moving into a niche, which, what happened was that I think media, not just in South Africa, but generally, kind of moved away from the stuff that they did well and started just doing the things that the Twitterati told them to do.
Yeah.
So, like you'll see that with the Mail and Guardian, how it's
lost the agenda,
the entire sensibility of, and identity of the Mail and Guardian got eroded over a period of time, of like a really traumatic time when I worked there as well. I think of like kind of restructuring and trying to like move towards a digital first kind of moment, right? But what it did was like it just kind of replicated a News 24 thing, There's always been a space for the things that we've always done very well, whether it's long form or even like kind of like a regular 800 word or 1,200 word piece, which is kind of still nuanced and detailed, right? I remember noticing this much earlier on, because I think there were some interesting sites in Sweden and also in France that we were looking at a time before Percy Lloyd and I started The Con, which was an experiment again, like around being like saying, no, let's not do the 24-hour news cycle and feed the beast constantly, but like actually let's take a step back and do like proper long form. And like this is like kind of like five or six of us, all journalists with like kind of no money aside from like stuff that we managed to raise through like projects and stuff. And we kept it going for 5 years. And I mean, we reached a point where we're kind of doing like 75, 80,000 hits a week, which is for like, which where we still kind of did our regular gigs. Wasn't too bad. I mean, I think one day we even got 75,000 hits in a day, which was kind of, yeah. But that was a racism and rugby story.
That'll do it. But I suppose, I mean, it does give you hope that there is still I don't want to sound snobbish, but I mean, a more nuanced and learned reading public does still exist if you can find them, or if you're writing stuff that appeals to them.
I think we're losing readers, and I think we're losing how we read. I think like how we absorb things and how we gain information. I can't start the day without having like kind of actually read the newspapers. Like I still go and buy the papers, right? I've just actually come out of a period where I hadn't read a book in about 2 months, because I was just kind of like working my computer, going through like Concord judgments and things like that, and documents on my computer and reading news on my computer, right? Even like long form stuff in the New Yorker, whatever. But I'm still kind of just focusing on my computer and on my phone. And after that 2 month period, I kind of went out, because I usually read books in piles, like kind of like get a theme and I just read like all of them at the same time. And my brain felt it worked differently after this 2 month period of not reading anything from a book. My imagination had shifted a little bit. I think it comes down to like kind of like dopamine and dopamine, like kind of highways that we have, and kind of like how we process stuff. I'd like to think there will always be a readership for kind of considered, forensically correct, fact-based journalism, not opinion. But I think we as a society and as individuals are moving away from that idea of community, from that idea of solidarity, which kind of behoves us to kind of read that kind of stuff. And then it's about narcissism and endorphin. And it's about kind of, social media and the interactions we have, the hysteria that we kind of feed or don't feed, and like our own vulnerabilities. These are all kind of things that affect how we consume news, what we take as fact, what we take as kind of fake. I'm an intellectual pessimist, but I'm kind of an optimist when it comes to the human spirit and what we can do. So I hope my cynicism and my pessimism is a little bit misplaced as we go forward.
I hope so too.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time this afternoon, Naren.
Thank you, Nick.
Really
and I'm
appreciate
sorry
it.
It's taken so long for you to get me here.
That was cool.
Cool.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, he said to me after our chat. He was maybe anticipating something a little bit more casual. But I think you do get a sense of his mission, if I can call it that, of his ongoing belief in the importance of fact-based long-form journalism in particular that rises above the mania of the 24-hour news cycle. As he says at the end, he's an intellectual pessimist. When sort of you look at the state of discussion and debate in the world, but at the same time an optimist for the human spirit. I've published links to some of the work referenced in our discussion on the Voices from SA Audio Boom site, so please check those out. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You can also subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating or a comment that helps spread the word about the podcast. You can also find Voices from SA on Spotify, Deezer, Radio Public, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.